Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for your regular host, David Inge. Glad you could listen. During the first hour of the show, we'll do something we always do on the third Friday of the month, talk about personal finance. This is an opportunity for you to call in and ask your questions about, I don't know, retirement, investments, saving, looking to the future, those kinds of issues. Any questions about those things are welcome. Our guest this morning, Kevin Waspy, he's a lecturer in the College of Business here at the University of Illinois. He joins us every once in a while, probably not often enough. We like having him around here, and he will be our person answering your questions. It sure won't be me during the show. So Kevin Waspy joins us to take your questions on personal finance. All you have to do is pick up the telephone and call us. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL, if that makes it easier to remember. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you can hear us, 800-222-9455. We'll talk about some things going on in the economy, but you're welcome to join us anytime during this hour. And Kevin Waspy, thanks so much for being here.
Well, thank you, Jack. That was a wonderful welcome, and I'm always happy to be here.
Great. Well, we're waiting for some people to call, and there's some things we could talk about. One of those things is, I don't know, inflation, the Fed, interest rates, small topics.
Small topics all. Again, we seem to find ourselves at a time when the mystery of what happens with policy, monetary policy specifically, will develop, will come out of the policymakers and what that means for the future of our economy. Interestingly, that we've been seeing the Federal Reserve manage interest rates higher for the past 18 months. Some people criticize the Fed for doing that. Some people actually criticize the Fed for not doing it faster and more vigorously. So, it, like any topic, it's always got both sides of a heated discussion. But that certainly has been the forefront on financial markets' minds.
Yeah. Well, the chairman, Ben Bernanke, I can't say his name. I haven't got used to saying his name yet.
I don't know if anyone says it.
Yeah. Certainly sort of stirred things up recently with some comments. And I don't know if this is something, you know, we can really say much about, but whatever your thoughts are in terms of his style seems to be different.
Well, that's another interesting development this time through, because we'd gotten so used to Alan Greenspan, and all market watchers were pretty much in tune with Alan speak.
Yeah.
So, in a sense, everybody's trying to learn a different language. I don't envy his position in trying to fill Greenspan's shoes. Greenspan had detractors too, few as they might be, but in any event, a new fella coming in to basically take the helm and allow what's supposed to be a semi-transparent process to become, you know, his process. I mean, that's just a heck of a transition.
Yeah. I saw a recent quote by Alan Greenspan that was, and I'm going to paraphrase it here, but I swear it was something like, if my comments seemed excessively clear, then let me rephrase them. You know, it was one of those.
Absolutely. The master of speak. Yeah.
Yeah, so the markets don't know quite how to respond. Of course, there are other signals that are going on. We seem to see some signs of inflation. And, you know, what can we say in general about, you know, as we look as individuals in our own investments during these times, are some things that you'd suggest we think about?
Yeah, as simple as it sounds, I really believe that all of the discussion about Fed policy, about the future of the economy, about things like interest rates and inflation, really tend to be cocktail conversation if we have a disciplined approach to investments. So, you know, again, as simple as this sounds, you can be entertained with all of those things. But in the long run, and as one famous economist, Keynes, once said, in the long run, we're all dead. That's not the long run that I want to speak about, but in the long run, if we set a good investment policy that fits our objectives and adjust to any change in the objectives, we're pretty much home free.
Mm-hmm.
As simple as it sounds, a practiced exercise of regular investment, whether a person's paid twice a month, once a month, whatever, if they're allocating a part of their income to a long-term investment structure and doing it in a cost-efficient manner, the kinds of things that we'll talk about today and on the minds of callers every day are really cocktail conversation items.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have one caller waiting. Let me just reintroduce our guest. We're talking this morning with Kevin Waspy. He's a lecturer in the College of Business here at the University of Illinois. He has a wide-ranging background in financial management services. So we're talking about personal finance. Your questions are welcome. We have one caller waiting. The number around Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to join us, 333-9455. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. First up, a listener in Urbana, line number one. Good morning. Hello?
Hello.
Yes.
I was interested in strategies for taking money out of a 401B, which I'll have to begin doing in a little less than a year.
When you say have to, is that because of the minimum distributions based on age?
Yes.
Okay. And the 403B plan, like any retirement plan that we might call a 401k or even an IRA itself, does have the minimum distribution requirements in effect. Once we reach the age of 70 and a half, we have to begin withdrawing those funds. So in trying to get a sense of the base of your question, can you tell me what you meant by methods?
Well, I'm wondering if it would actually be better to take it out faster than the minimum and reinvest it. Because as it grows now, it's all subject to income tax. But if I were to take it out and reinvest it, it would then be subject to capital gains, which would probably be about half as high.
In the current tax laws, I agree the differential between the capital gains tax rate and certainly the highest rate on income is about twice. The question you've asked is an interesting question. It's something that I would advise you to probably talk with somebody specifically, and what I mean with specifically is to your circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
Do you recall the time when Roth IRAs were first made available roughly 7 years ago?
Yes, I bought one at that time.
Okay. A big topic of conversation when Roth IRAs were first created, and to a lesser extent it's still a popular topic today, is for people to pull money out of a traditional tax-deferred plan, an IRA, a 403B, or 401K plan, whichever, pay the tax on it, and roll the money into a Roth IRA. And everybody went through a different massage and said, well, here's the taxes I pay at the present, and you know, here's the implied savings and taxes in the future, and so on and so forth. I saw very few instances personally where it made sense for a person to do that. And as a person gets to an age of a minimum mandatory distribution from a qualified plan, I'm believing that I'm going to see even less likelihood where that might make sense. But again, that's all on the surface of things. It's all in a sense of generalities. And I really do advise you that your best course of action is to talk with someone who's a fee-only, no incentive to sell you product type mm-hmm. of advisor, and literally lay out your specifics so that they can go through the what-ifs.
I'm assuming that as I'll also have a business now, that I'll probably be paying at the maximum on the withdrawals. But of course, at some time in the future, it could well be that I would not be having that amount of income, and I suppose the growth is apt to be greater, it should be greater, in the 401. If I leave as much in it as I can, take the minimum.
Yeah, certainly as the remaining money stays in the qualified plan, it's growing tax-deferred. So in any amount of its ability to grow in a compounded tax-deferred manner, you've certainly got a bias to want to keep the money sheltered as long as you can.
Any other things to consider that I haven't?
Well, the thing that kind of springs from that is you've mentioned a business, and we've got a rough sense of age. Not to be morbid, but what springs to mind is, have you done any estate planning work?
Yes.
Okay. Then I think the issues revolving, around a business, around qualified retirement monies, and now your attainment of age and minimum distributions, it might be wise to revisit someone that helps with that type of advice. So, I'm thinking again in the attorney sense and the accountant sense, somebody who's going to literally sit down and say, let's do some what-ifs and see where this makes most sense for you.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like good advice. Certainly stay away from someone who is selling something.
Well, I mean, there should, I would assume that you have a good working relationship with an attorney, given a business and given the estate plan in place. I would also assume that given some business that you've had help with tax matters, CPA-related matters. My personal bias is not, what do I want to say here? What I want to say is I think your money is the next thing to your health. So if you have a good rapport with an MD, that's a wonderful thing. I think you should have a good rapport with a financial advisor as well.
Well, thank you.
Okay. Thanks for the call. We have another caller waiting, and our lines are fairly open, which is rare on these shows. So if you want to get in early, we'll try to get your question answered quick. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. Anywhere else you hear us around the Midwest, or if you're listening online anywhere in the continental U.S., 800-222-9455. We'll go next to a listener in Champaign, line number two. Good morning.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a maybe kind of strange question. You've undoubtedly read the last few days and weeks about what is happening at the Chicago Tribune.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious, at one time a few years ago, I wanted to buy some stock in the Tribune. That was when they were more diversified. They had yet again an extremely interesting plan for education. And then they sold that off. That was before they melded, I think, with Times Mirror.
Mm-hmm.
I could not afford to run right out and buy, thousands of dollars worth of stock. And what I buy is with the drip method.
Yes, ma'am.
Now, would this right now be a wise time to purchase some Tribune stock or not? This quarrel going on, but... I read in this morning's Tribune, Credit Suisse Boston gave them an outperform rating.
Well, I understand that, but Credit Suisse, I'm sure, did not guarantee that recommendation either.
No, I don't think they did.
Yeah. In the individual stock advice type of category, I find myself nervous given that kind of advice on the radio. But let me go ahead and walk out on the limb and fall off. Despite your assumptions of what happens at the Tribune, the fight that's going on right now between members of the board of directors as to the future course of the company, should we sell ourselves, should we split ourselves into two or more companies, all of the different strategies that are being discussed, unfortunately, in the public, which is some kind of embarrassment for the company itself. Those are all wild cards. Would it be a good time to buy the stock? The answer is yes, if you have risk capital. And the reason I say that is because every time you've got a greater set of unknowns as opposed to a lesser set of unknowns, you've got more risk. And like most things in your life, you'll find that the more risk you're able to stomach, the greater the potential return. Now, just remember that we define risk with investments as the possibility that you don't get a positive rate of return.
Mm-hmm.
You end up losing money. So that's why I say, yeah, it might be a good time to buy Tribune stock with speculative money, meaning my lifestyle won't be changed a bit if it just totally goes away.
All right, fine. Thank you very much.
Right. You're welcome.
Thanks for the call. We might talk more about that if we get time. I think it's very interesting what's happening with the Tribune and with media in general.
It's funny that we talk about the Tribune because when I was just getting ready to walk up here, phone rang and a former student was calling who happens to work at the Chicago Tribune right now. And it was we didn't have time to talk, but we've been kind of trading emails back and forth about what's going on with the Trib and all of the, you know, the kind of quarreling that's out in the public. And I know it's just kind of tearing him up as an employee of the company.
Well, we have a caller waiting. Let's get to them. Someone on a cell phone, line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes, good morning. I have a question. I am getting ready to close on selling a farm, and I'm going to get roughly $1 million on the sale of this farm. I'm interested in putting that money into a 1031 exchange and buy some more property. However, I'm 61 years old, and I don't really need the money right now, but I'm wondering what you think about investing in a more of a diversified portfolio, taking my lumps, I just paying the capital gains tax, and doing that rather than getting more interest in real estate, which I have about $1.5 million invested in real estate now.
As with the first caller, what I'd say is my guess is you've worked with an attorney.
Mm-hmm.
You've worked with somebody to help you on the tax aspect of things, and you probably have a decent rapport with somebody that helps you with accounting for those matters. Is that true?
Yes, that's true.
Well, I would have to go with their best advice in terms of how you structure it. The 1031 exchange that you mentioned is certainly a very tax-favorable way to dispose of real property.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean that you should make investment decisions predicated solely on the tax implications. But given the amount of money, given the size of the transaction that you're discussing, that's certainly one element that is larger than many other, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, unless everything's been determined and it's all ironed out, my approach to it would be literally sit down with the attorney, with the accountant, and say, okay, throw it all on the table. What can I do, and what does it cost me?
Right. Okay. I think what I'll end up doing, and I've had some conversations, is kind of do a 50-50. Some of it will go further into real estate, some will come out, and I'll put it into a portfolio such that I can kind of withstand some bumps in the road.
Yeah, and you've just hit to another key issue. The basis of your question really revolves around diversification. The old adage, don't keep all your eggs in one basket, and I'm a great believer in that. So, you know, sometimes it costs us in a variety of ways, in a handful of different ways. It costs us to get the advantages that diversification gives us. So if one of those costs happens to be paying tax on a portion of the sale, well, then so be it. We live in a world where death and taxes are almost the two certainties.
Right, and the capital gains will almost assuredly be going up in the future, so may take some of that out now.
Yeah, I wouldn't bet on the future tax policies that come out of Washington, D.C. any more than mm-hmm. I'd bet on a horse race and feel comfortable. No, I'll take that back. I'd feel more comfortable on the horse race. But bottom line is you've certainly acknowledged that capital gains tax rates, at least right now, are at the lowest level they've been for a very long time.
Right. Well, so. I really enjoy your show, and thank you for taking my call.
Well, thank you.
Thanks so much for calling. Bye. We're talking this morning with Kevin Waspy. He is a lecturer in the College of Business here at the University of Illinois. He teaches courses in financial markets, investments, and employee benefits. He has a wide background in financial planning. If you would like to ask questions on those topics, you are welcome. We have one caller lined up and plenty of time for others if you want to join us. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. We'll go next to a listener in Decatur, line number two. Good morning.
Professor Waspy.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you, sir?
I'm swell, and you?
I'm swell also. I have a question that I'll ask, and then I'll hang up and listen.
Thank you.
How can the individual investor play the hedge fund and private equity game. Thank you.
Hedge funds and private equity. Well, let's see. Hedge funds. First of all, the name to me is kind of a misnomer. Hedge funds, the generic term applies to less regulated investment pools of money. So as an alternative, for instance, to a mutual fund, a person getting into a hedge fund, generally speaking, has more onus, more stringent requirements on themselves. In other words, they have to have a higher net worth. They have to have higher annual income, because hedge funds are supposed to be for quote-unquote sophisticated investors. That being said, the word hedge, or trying to remove risk, in most of these investment pools is anything but what goes on. So the bottom line is these are risky investment pools for very well-heeled individuals. For the common person like me or Jack Brighton, to get into a hedge fund is probably something that doesn't fit our needs. It's probably something that is more risk than we can afford and requires a bigger investment up front than we would be prudent to make. The second aspect, private equity. Private equity is become more and more a topic of discussion. Private equity basically means, again, some pool of well-heeled investors. They put a pot of money together. They buy companies. So miniature versions of what Warren Buffett has done with Berkshire Hathaway. Berkshire Hathaway, the conglomeration that basically uses Geico Insurance as the foundation company. But then its operations, aside from the insurance aspect of things, their operations in investing capital literally go to buying companies. Again, private equity is a topic of great discussion, whether you pick up a Wall Street Journal or a Financial Times or whatever, the business section of the Chicago Tribune. You will read stories about private equity investors. Generally speaking, though, they live in houses bigger than my neighborhood, have incomes greater each year than my net worth, and generally speaking, don't kind of fall in the ranks of individual investors.
Hope that gets to the caller's question. And, you know, you mentioned hedge funds not being something that I'd be likely to participate in. Well, actually, I do participate in a hedge fund. It's my gardening budget, but, you know.
Oh, I like that. Privet hedges?
Yeah. Yeah, they're actually very effective, you know, for their purpose. Okay. Well, we're just about at our midpoint here with Kevin Waspy, taking your questions on personal finance, investing, retirement issues, anything pertaining to your financial health. Those questions are welcome. We have another caller waiting, and the number again around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Next up, someone on line number 4 in the Chicago suburbs. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm calling for information about a person who's retired who has a small amount of money to invest and was advised to maybe get a timeshare or something like that. But they heard about investing in the farms in southern Illinois or in eastern Illinois, helping the farmers by putting their money into their seed funds and gaining something back from it, but I'm not sure what. Do you know anything about that?
No, I'm ignorant to that opportunity. This was an opportunity for people to invest in, you said, a seed fund?
Existing farms that are downstate.
And would this be like a partial ownership of the ground itself? Or?
Well, I think it gives them access to the market of whatever the products are, or opportunity to maybe spend some time down there. Or I don't know, but you put a couple hundred dollars a month into it or something to help the farmer, and certainly that would be more worthy than a timeshare, I think.
I really have to confess my ignorance here. I'm not familiar with anything like that, but the hair on the back of my neck is kind of standing up right now because, you know, when we invest money, we should have basically an investment process in mind. Mm-hmm. It's admirable to consider helping others in society. Mm-hmm. Things like charitable contributions, or how should we say, just being a good, upstanding member of society, and you know, following the golden rule. I mean, these are the types of things that you know I firmly believe in and try to practice daily. However, when I look at an investment process, aside from the capitalistic benefits that society gains from that investable, I try not to mix charitable and investable qualities in the same package. I have seen, unfortunately, in the past, some aspects of people's approaching potential investors and relying on their heartstrings, all basically under the guise of stealing their money. Now, don't think that I'm not trying to accuse what you've heard of as being a scheme to part you from your money or your friend's money. But again, that's why the hair on the back of my neck stood up. Charity is a good thing. I think that's something that we all ought to strive to be charitable people, whether it's donating money to a cause that we believe in or just living our lives as we should each day. But the investment process is something separate. Don't mix the two, because the results of both will usually be disappointing.
Okay. Well, thank you for that advice. We'll certainly be very careful before we venture into this.
Okay.
That,
great. Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks for the call. Now, you know, along those lines, I mean, there are like limited partnerships in owning farmland that, you know, that seem to be fairly beneficial for a lot of people. And that's a different animal altogether.
Yeah. In a limited partnership arrangement, the opportunity for people to come together and do what they want to do has existed for an awful long time with an awful lot of asset investment potentials. So if it's farm ground, a limited partner would come in with risk capital, money that they could afford to lose, that they would expect to earn a rate of return on, and perhaps a general partner may be the operator of the farm. That's an opportunity. It's a wonderful opportunity. When a person goes into a limited partnership, though, they need to have the confidence in the individuals that they would need to have in their own physician, in their own attorney, again, because a partnership is literally dependent upon its weakest member. The other thing that a person needs to realize is that unlike most investments, a limited partnership has very, very a lot less liquidity. In other words, you might think that it's a good time to pull your money out and move it somewhere else, or you might need your money and find that you don't have the opportunity to sell that partnership interest. Or if you did have the opportunity to sell it, it would be at such a discounted price because somebody was basically taking advantage of the lack of liquidity. So all those kinds of considerations certainly work into limited partnerships, which means, for the most part, younger people with more risk capital are greater potential investors in a limited partnership than are older people with less risk capital.
Well, good. We have a couple callers waiting. We'll go next to a Champagne listener on line number one. Good morning.
Yeah, hi. First one, I'm not there yet. I'm on my way, but somebody raised the issue of the distribution. What is it, at 70.5? Is there a percentage, or is that the formula's changed, or I'm not sure on that one?
Yeah, the minimum distribution rules for qualified retirement plans basically are unchanged in the big picture. A person's life expectancy is used. You're allowed to determine that based on a single life, yours, or a joint life expectancy, you and a spouse, perhaps. You look at the sum of money in the pot, you divide it by the life expectancy, and that basically becomes the first year's minimum distribution. You're allowed to recalculate life expectancies each year if you choose that path, or you can stick with the amortization as calculated from the get-go. The nuances, change slightly from year to year, tax code to tax code. But the bottom line is, a life expectancy is the factor that determines how much you get as a minimum based on the pot of money there.
So is that today, let's say for a male, 10 years, 12 years, you know, in other words, 70 would be 80 something? Is that how that's figured?
Are you asking what your life expectancy is?
Yeah, how does that?
The actuarial tables that the Internal Revenue Service uses are easily available on the web. You could click up there and you could say, at the time of my last day, birthday, I was this old.
Okay.
Here's my life expectancy.
Mm-hmm.
So those numbers of years, as the divisor, the numerator being the number of dollars in the total number of dollars in all qualified plans, and that basically gives you the minimum distribution for the current year.
Mm-hmm. So I thought it was a percentage, but it's not a percentage.
No.
Okay. The second question is that in terms of default on a loan, is that still deductible then from your 1040?
Yeah, to limits, and that's, again, dependent upon a person's income and the amount of loss on the loan itself. So our tax code never shrinks, unfortunately. We keep printing offices busy around the clock. I would suggest you go to the IRS's webpage, irs.gov, and look at the facts, the frequently asked questions related to personal loan loss deductions.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks very much for the call. Next up, listener in Lodge, Illinois, line number two. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question. I have a parent that's in the nursing home. Been in the nursing home, I think, about a little over two years now, and they still own a home. And I was wondering if there's a rule as far as taxes about when you sell that property, that they have to have lived in the residence for two of the last 5 years, or can you explain that to me?
In terms of the favorable treatment of capital gains on the sale?
Yes.
I won't go out on this limb because given the complication of a parent in a nursing home, I would like you to talk with somebody who's either a CPA, very knowledgeable in this area, or a tax attorney. And the reason I say that is residency might be an issue. And in other words, the fact that they are not able to live in the home as opposed to choosing not to live in the home and instead renting it out. Do you see the subtle difference?
Yes.
That might be the hinge pin in determining residency and therefore the favorable tax treatment.
Okay. So just check with the CPA then.
Anytime we're talking about a substantial difference in, the amount of money, the implications of what taxes or penalties or whatever, I want to go to an expert.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call. Our lines are open. We have just about maybe 15 minutes left with our guest, Kevin Waspy. He's a lecturer in finance at the College of Business at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, talking about money management, investing, and financial health. Any of those questions you have burning are welcome with Kevin Waspy this morning. All you have to do is call us around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Yeah, I have a question about interest rates and how that might relate to our behavior with regard to, part of our portfolio. What are some of the things, as interest rates seem to be creeping up and may continue? I mean, we can't predict exactly when the Fed is going to stop raising interest rates, but there's been, a series of 16 raises or something in the past couple
right.
of years. What are some of the things that we might think about?
Well, again, I'm going to presume that we're talking about a commitment to a long-term savings plan or an investment strategy. And in a sense, without saying it, again, this simple, if you're satisfied with the plan and your conditions that existed at the time you set the plan up haven't changed greatly, you probably don't want to do anything different with what's going on with interest rates. And here's just kind of like some of the thoughts off the top of my head. If you had a diversified plan from the get-go, some money's always going into stocks, some money's always going into bonds, perhaps some money's always going into real estate. As interest rates rise, the value of bonds are falling. So that's bad news to the bonds that I already own.
Mm-hmm.
But it's good news when you think about the fresh money coming in, because you see, they just put bonds on sale. So you're buying more bonds with the same number of dollars. Mm-hmm. Why would I change that course? Or why would I go to Sears when I could go to Penny's and get the same thing on sale? So, you know, that's the kind of notion, and that's kind of one of the nice things about a set-and-forget type of policy mm-hmm. with investment that allows you to have regular contributions, regular investment purchases over time. The other opportunity, of course, is to look at it from the trader's perspective, and now you're going to make a bet. You're going to make a short-term prediction about where interest rates are heading, and I'm not beyond betting. I like investments, and I like speculation, and I think there's a place for that activity where you have that interest that you know is an offshoot. What I would also say is that doesn't deviate my core money. That's the play money or the speculative money, and in that sense, I would say that. The horse is probably mostly out of the barn in an interest rate play. I'm assuming that we've seen about 95% of the interest rate increases that we were going to see. Just like in 2000, I was assuming that interest rates were going to drop like a stone because it seemed like there was a threat of a recession. I thought the Fed would be extremely accommodative. I took moves in 2000 that made a bet that interest rates would drop strongly. Now, I undid that bet. I removed the bet maybe a little too early because in 2004, I sold most of those bonds that I bought making that bet. I could have ridden them a little longer and made a little bit more, but I never lose sight of the old saying, bulls make a little, bears make a little, and hogs get slaughtered.
Well, very good. We have another caller waiting, and I might have a follow-up on that if there's time. We'll go next to another listener on Urbana, line number one. Good morning.
Hello. A mm-hmm. general question, then I'll hang up. Can you tell me something about various investment bundles, like exchange-traded funds and holders and MITs? I think I have some knowledge of exchange-traded funds and some experience with them, but the other two are a little mysterious to me. They have separate listings in the Wall Street Journal, for example. Thanks.
Sure. The whole area of investable funds in the form of pools of money has just exploded over the past 10 years. What we used to think was the greatest pool of money that existed in terms of a collective investment process, mutual funds, that have been around for an awful long time, have just literally mutated. So exchange-traded funds are sort of like mutual funds that exist as shares of stock that trade on an exchange, whether that's the New York Stock Exchange or an over-the-counter NASDAQ type of exchange market. All of the other different permutations and the funny acronyms that have been used to describe basically are another form or derivative of that structure. So they basically boil down to the difference between whether they are closed-end investment companies or unit investment trusts in terms of their actual what they do for investors and where they are traded. Those are just characteristics. What they do for investors, for the most part, isn't changed based on the structural form of the entity itself. So whether it's a unit investment trust, whether it's a closed-end share investment company, those are not the important things. The important things are, as always, what the money actually gets invested in. So if that fulfills your objectives, that's cool. How cost-efficient they are, if they're competitive with other instruments available that accomplish the same goals, that's cool. And then finally is liquidity. My own feeling on exchange-traded funds is, for the most part, we don't need them. If a person's going to take mutual funds as a means for a long-term investment strategy, they don't need daily liquidity. They don't need to buy and sell them 6.5 hours a day every minute the market is open. If we're going to trade them, that's a different matter. Then the liquidity comes at an advantage. But I always remind myself that with any benefit, there is a cost attached. So exchange-traded funds might be, or any of the other acronyms, any of the other derivatives of them, might be more beneficial as it goes to things like liquidity for a trading purpose, But in terms of accomplishing a goal, why bother?
Hope that gets the caller's question. We have another listener waiting, someone in Champaign, line number 2. Good morning.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question for the financial professor. Yeah, because recently the financial market up and down so heavily, and so it's the main reason people said it's about the inflation. We know that inflation is always the negative effect influence to the financial market. From beginning of this year, it's always like a cloud above the financial market. So another opinion is the person replaced like the Federal Reserve, the Alan Greenspan was replaced by the Bernanke,
mm-hmm.
and the Secretary of the Treasury Department, the John Snow will be replaced by the Henry Paulin.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the replacement is also the reason for the market panic.
Let me answer your question simply. Yes. Not to be funny, but just to be commonsensical about it. Markets on a day-to-day basis are basically showing us noise. I would almost go as far as calling it meaningless noise.
Okay.
Even on a week-to-week or month-to-month, the volatility in markets is little more than the outgrowth of speculative ventures. So that's how I kind of come to calling it noise. In the greater scheme of things, are financial markets concerned about things like inflation? Sure they are, because it has serious long-term repercussions. If inflation is something that is getting out of hand, the Federal Reserve wants to try to keep that damage contained. They'll raise interest rates. Is there a risk that they run, that they push the economy into a slow growth or possible recession even? Yes, all of these things have repercussions, and all of the what-ifs lead to the uncertainty. The uncertainty culminates in day-to-day, week-to-week, even month-to-month volatility that, again, is noise. Over the long run, if there's any comfort in it, and, you know, for what it is, I can lie with statistics as well as anybody. Looking at the U.S. stock market, since 1965, I didn't bother to go back to 1926 because I didn't figure too many of us were investing back then. But since 1965, the U.S. stock market's returned about 11.6% average. Now I got to point out that it's been a volatile return. So if you wanted to look again at the annual rates of return, that's been associated with a 16.5% standard deviation. So the bottom line to me is volatility over the long run is one of the reasons why I like a structured approach to investments that means a regular amount of money is continually being invested. Every time I get a paycheck, well, I don't get a paycheck, I get a direct deposit. But every month when I'm paid, I have a portion of that money go directly into investment funds. And I just look at it as a time process. It's a dollar cost averaging process so that when the volatility brings me to a point when prices are low, I'm buying more investments than when the prices are high. That's how I use volatility to help me.
Okay, that's great. Yeah. And compare the two reasons. Recently the Valentine's is so it's actually it's unreasonable. It's the inflation is the main reason, or the replacement is the main reason.
We've only named two of what I would probably say are a minimum of 100 reasons.
Okay.
I'm not trying to be short with you, or I'm not trying to make you feel bad. Please don't think that. But when you think about how much information and how many different variables there are in something like an economy, trying to quantify them and then even trying to say that this one or these two or these 10 are the reasons is just too we're kidding ourselves. The the mathematics that allows us to take uncertainty to the 56th decimal place does not make up for the basic complexity of the process itself. So, you know, we can be very precise with an analysis, an econometric model, but the one thing that we cannot do is simplify the actual system itself, which is an extremely complicated macroeconomic system.
Okay, yeah, I understand. So we all know that for the long run, the basic factor or basic influence to the financial market should be the economic data. So could you tell me, what's your opinion for the, I mean, someone told us the American economy will be slowed down in the future. So what's your opinion for the, could you give me some forecast for the financials, for the economic growth in the future?
What time frame? As long as I'm going to walk out on a limb, how far do I have to walk?
For 2 years, for 1 or 2 years.
For the next 2 years?
Yes.
I don't see a big change from the economic process that we're in. My personal belief is I think the economy is stronger than people might tell us it is. It's more resilient. It's not going to be as gangbusters as it was early throughout 2005 and in the first part of 2006, but that's okay. I mean, it's going to continue to expand. I don't see a recession in the coming 2 years.
Okay. Okay, yeah. For the third question is, some people say that for political reason that it's now these 2 years is the third term for President Bush, and he has no pressure to be the re-elected for the third term, right? So he will do something a little bit aggressive to boom the economy, so that the financial market will be also boomed by the economy boomed, just like in 1999 to 2000 as the last term of last 2 years of President Clinton. So do you think this is reasonable reason?
Again, for any single factor, I'm always nervous saying this factor will cause that. The system is just too integrated with too many variables to bring any comfort to that. And you know, I mean, on the topic of President Bush, I think we give President Bush too much credit for having too much power over many things. He's obviously a very visible figurehead, but he's also got 535 people that he needs to fight with in the House of Representatives and the Senate. And, you know, those people all have their own agendas. Sometimes they're cutting deals with each other. You know, again, the system of politics is probably the most complex system I could ever imagine. So laying that one on top of an economically complex system, I think we could have great cocktail discussion, but I'd never put any money to play based on what we discussed.
It is fun to speculate, though. And as you say, there's so many factors and it's a very complex system in the classic sense that it's hard to, you know, pin anything on one of those factors. And we just have a couple minutes left, so I'll just suggest that we focus on one of those factors because it's
fun.
Sure. And that is,
let's have a cocktail.
Okay. The price of oil.
Uh-huh.
Because as we talk about inflation, we talk about productivity and risk and all the things that are going on politically and economically, oil seems to be one of those sort of central features.
Mm-hmm. I think the price of oil is way too cheap. Anybody that knows me might react kind of at first with a sigh of, I can't believe he said that. But I've thought oil is extremely cheap for a long time, and even at $70 a barrel, well, $65, I think it's cheap. And here's what I mean when I say that. It's cheap because we don't account for the cost of oil in the world markets with everything that goes into keeping the supply as it is in meeting the demand at present. So it's not difficult to look at the billions of dollars that the U.S. military spends keeping the flow of oil from a very politically unstable region flowing. Whether it's the Middle East or Africa, and this is a known quantity. We've known this for the past 50 years. Most of the reserves of the world's potential oil supply are in areas of very unstable political circumstances. So it's that cost to the world for a barrel of oil that I think is unreasonably low, because you and I, all of us U.S. taxpayers, have been paying a very large bill to keep the world oil markets pumping, producing, and distributing that oil. So is oil something that's politically sensitive right now or economically sensitive right now? Absolutely. The fact that we haven't seen measured inflation in different parts of our economy or many economies throughout the world, given the sharp rise of oil over the past year and a half, is pretty amazing. For a second cocktail, I think I could explain why that is. But in the course of this first cocktail, I'll just say that oil prices will continue to be ever more a point to focus on, or a point for people to worry about, or markets to be volatile over. That just seems to me to be too easy to see the handwriting on the wall. Again, we've known where the reserves are. We've known where new production's coming from. We've known what the political developments and evolutionary processes have been in these very unstable areas. We don't see them getting a whole lot more stable. And quite honestly, I you know, unless somebody declares world peace tomorrow, I can't see it changing.
Well, on that note, we're going to have to stop. We're out of time. Our guest, again, Kevin Wasby, lecturer at the College of Business at the University of Illinois. And thank you very much for being here.
Thanks, Jack. It was a great pleasure.